The Committee of the Whole will please come to order.
Shall I just go ahead, Lisa?
Okay. Madam Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chairman Wilson. Ladies and gentlemen, I just have a slight adjustment in your general file, so listen up. We are going to make the changes above House Joint Resolution 3, so that's the second bill on general file. The first bill we hear this afternoon will be House Bill 128. House Bill 128. And then we will continue with House Joint Resolution 3, House Bill 108, House Bill 130. House Bill 142 will be taken off a general file and brought down to the bottom of the list on the back of page 2. And then on page 2 of your general file, House Bill 209 will be also put at the bottom of your list. Okay? Enjoy your afternoon.
Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a particular personal privilege here. I want to introduce you to a young gentleman who's an educator. His education specialty has been in the past with alternative schools. And in the alternative schools, the two that he works with had 100% proficiency last year in mathematics. He had 100% proficiency in English. And then astounding, but you gotta believe this, pay attention to this one, he had 100% proficiency in writing. He was last year's Teacher of the Year, very fittingly. I am really pleased to introduce Mark Wyatt. Mark, for this house.
Welcome to the house. Representative Supson.
Madam Chairman, can I have privilege of the floor?
Go ahead.
On this very special day, I would like to wish you all a very happy Groundhog's Day.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 128. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 128 from Representative Greer, an act relating to time requirements, amending specified time requirements for issuance of notice to business days, creating a definition and providing for an effective date. Madam Chairman, to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 128, notice requirements, respectfully reports back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Byrd, Kennedy, Edmonds, Gay, Kasparyk, Larson, Lockhart, Somers, and Walters. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Vice Chairman Kasparyk?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation that, well, excuse me, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 128 do pass. I further move the Standing Committee Amendment, and I'll turn both the bill and the discussion of the Standing Committee Amendment over to the bringer of the bill.
Representative Greer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. So I'll explain the bill real quick and then bring in the Standing Committee Amendment as part of the explanation. So throughout certain parts of the statute, we use this term where we say X number of days before notice is sent out or before something has to be done. And there's been some confusion in some that was brought to me. Does that mean business days or regular days? And so in my day job, we follow a set of rules that makes it clear that anything under 10 days means business days, and anything over 10 days is regular days. So the group that brought this to my attention fell within the special districts. And so what I wanted to do was make it clear, because as we looked at this issue, we could not find anywhere where it was clear. 10 days, calendar days, or 10 business days. It just said 10 days. No guidance anywhere else in the statute. So my first thought was, hey, let's do something that makes this clear throughout all our statutes, that when we're talking about something under 10 days, we're talking business days, which would take out weekends and holidays. And then if it's a longer period of time, we would talk about calendar days. So you'll see on the bill, it actually starts on page 2. What I had was a provision in Title 8, and for those that don't particularly care, Title 8 talks about common law statutes and construction. And by putting this business day definition in that section, it would apply to all of the statutes where we talk about 10 days, 20 days, or 30 days. Well, as I found out in Title 17, which is deals with business entities, we have used the term business days 23 times, and that term business days, it was intended to be calendar days. Long story short, I ran into some conflicts with some of the other agencies here in the state. So I would like to correct that, but that is something I'll take upon myself working with the agency that was, or the section of government that was affected, and I'll work on that later. But for right now, I want to deal with the section on these special districts, in particular conservation districts, and make an amendment to the statute that's everywhere where it says 10 days, and there's a place in there where it says 7 days, that we are talking about business days. That is, when a notice has to go out or an action is required that requires 10 days, that we will exclude holidays and weekends. So with that explanation, which I probably made more difficult than necessary, what I would like to do is ask for the question on the standing committee amendment, which simply deletes that portion on page 2, which would have that have broad definitions throughout all the statutes, and it would simply then insert this definition of business days just in 22, 29 throughout that, which are all the special districts. So I'll ask any questions, but right now I just call for the question on the standing committee amendment.
Is there any discussion on the amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor of standing committee amendment number 1, please say aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted, and Representative Greer, we're back on the bill.
Yeah, and as I see everyone running to the microphone, I'll just be quiet and answer any questions or call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Vice Chair Kasparek's notion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill 128 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? House Bill 128 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 3. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Joint Resolution number 3 from the Federal Natural Resource Management Office, a joint resolution requesting Congress, state, and local authorities to take action to remediate damages caused by free-roaming wild horses on rangelands in the West, and to develop effective fertility control methods to reduce the populations of free-roaming wild horses in the West. Madam Chairman, your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom is referred House Joint Resolution 3, Free-Roaming Wild Horses, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Hunt, Yeagy, Larson, Lindholm, and McKee, signed by Representative Eklund, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. Chairman McKim, what is your pleasure?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that House Joint Resolution Number 3 do pass. And I'll turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative standing in front of us.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I bring you House Joint Resolution 3, which was a bill from our select Federal Natural Resource Management Federal Natural Resource Management Committee. And I got an interpretation. Because it says BLM in the land, I can say BLM. This will send a joint resolution requesting Congress, state and local authorities to take action to remediate damages caused by free roaming wild horses on the rangeland. Call on Congress and federal agencies to fund and support efforts to manage free roaming wild horses on rangeland in the West, while at the same time protecting rangeland resources. In the bill, it mentions $58 million. I've got hot off the press on the BLM's website. Congress appropriated $77.245 million to the Wild Horse and Burro Program in fiscal year 2014. Right now, they estimate out on the range 49,209 horses and burros on the range. In Wyoming, there's approximately 4,000. I think those numbers might be a little low, but also off the range in holding pens and herd management or short-term corrals and long-term pastures, there's 47,925 horses that we're feeding. So about 50,000 horses out on the range, about 50,000 we're spending millions upon millions of dollars to feed these horses. And this is just a bill to send a message to the BLM. They need to take care of this problem. Also, the BLM has a thing called the Basin Rapid Ecoregional Assessment. It goes through all the things that are affecting the Wyoming Basin. They have on their mammals that affect that basin pygmy rabbits, mule deer, pronghorn, and elk. Now, I asked the BLM, why aren't horses included in a species that's harming our rangeland? They didn't have a good answer for me. In two separate meetings, I asked that question. So they are an invasive species in my mind. They're feral horses. They weren't ever here to begin with. But we need some out there. There are some areas where tourists come. It is a tourist draw something, but we need to keep those numbers down. And I would urge you to support this bill, and I think we have an amendment. So please support this bill. I'd stand for any questions.
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would like to move House Joint Resolution Number 3, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. And I hope everybody has their corrected copy in hand. On page, first of all, this amendment comes from some of the testimony we received from some county commissioners, different agencies, all giving us very good input on this joint resolution, and it's all compiled here in this Committee of the Whole Amendment, hence why it's pretty big. Page 1, line 2, or page 1, line 2, after action 2, insert prevent further damage, and then page 2, line 14, we insert another whereas group, and that is specifically because of the sage-grouse areas that Wyoming is concentrated on and we've been very successful on. Some of those areas coincide with these free roaming horses, and the damage that they've done to this sage grouse habitat is contradictory to our efforts. And that states, whereas the state of Wyoming has a federally approved sage grouse conservation plan, the efficacy of which is being compromised and continuing habitat damage resulting from free roaming horses. And then we continue on with the rest of the resolution there. Page 3, line 15, after 2, insert adequately. After support, insert all. Page 3, line 17, after west, delete, balance of line, and insert utilizing all methods envisioned and authorized in the Wild Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act. Some of those efforts are not being utilized by the BLM currently at this time, and it's our vision to encourage those methods, whether they be to actually spay mares or things along those lines. Page 3, line 18, delete entirely. Page 4, after line 4, insert section 3. That the Wyoming legislature calls on Congress to prohibit the reintroduction of wild horses back onto the western rangelands outside the current herd management areas, nor onto existing herd management areas at or above the authorized management levels. Section 4, that the Wyoming legislature calls on Congress and federal agencies to prioritize these requested management activities to the sage-grouse core areas and priority habitat strongholds in order to reduce the possibility of an endangered listing for the sage-grouse and to stop the resource damage now occurring. Page 4, line 6, delete section 3, insert section 5. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Summers.
Madam Chairman, I stand on support of this amendment and this bill. You know, the continual growth of wild horses on our rangelands is probably its greatest threat, and particularly in core sage-grouse areas. With all the issues we have surrounding sage-grouse and their status, I think this amendment's a good idea just to focus in on those and also to ensure that they're not reintroduced on rangelands that currently where there are no horses. So once again, on in support of the amendment and the resolution. Thank you.
Representative Walters.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To the bringer of this amendment, I'd just like to ask, when you reference what was envisioned in this, I'm a little concerned that they could come back and say they envisioned seeing wild horses roaming freely and that all our cattle and sheep ought to leave the rangeland. So I'm a little concerned that envisioned could be interpreted in a negative context for Wyoming. Could you explain how you can defend and prove what that vision was all these years later?
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. That's specifically in regards to the Wild Horse and Burro Act, as specifically as possible as that bill was written. Those are the guidelines that we have to live within, and those are the guidelines that we ask these federal agencies to live within also, and that's what we're pertaining to. Thank you.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I view this as a friendly amendment, and I was going to call for the question. It looks like there's more debate. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is simply this. If we're going to make a statement like that, do we have the data, not anecdotal stuff, do we have the data to support this statement that wild horses, I mean, I think I know the answer, but if we don't have data, we have no business sending this to Congress. Do we have data to support the tension or the exclusivity between wild horses and sage-grouse habitats such that we can say from a data-driven approach that wild horses are a threat to our sage-grouse core areas and what we're trying to accomplish there?
Representative Lindholm.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I do not have that data on hand now, but the data that was, or the testimony that was given during committee, I believe substantiates that, and we can get that data, and I do believe it does prove that.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of how, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The amendment has passed. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of House Joint Resolution 3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The resolution has passed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 108. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 108 from Representative Miller, an act relating to property, specifying the duty of care a landowner owes to a trespasser, providing definitions and providing for an effective date. Madam Chairman of Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 108, Trespass-Landowner Liability, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Allen, Blake, Campbell, Eklund, Hunt, Yeagy, Larson, Lindholm, and McKim, signed by Representative Eklund, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McKim?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, they do so with a recommendation that House Bill 108 do pass, and I further move the Standing Committee Amendment, which I'll explain at this time. The Standing Committee Amendment, if you look on page 3, simply adds the word and on lines 11, 16, and 21. And all this does, Madam Chairman, is make an attempt to tie those conditions all together so that they all have to be met for this to pass. For further explanation, you want to talk on that?
Question being called on the amendment. All those in... beg your pardon. Representative Greer.
Madam Chairwoman, I would ask that we defeat this amendment simply because it's not necessary. I understand the full intent here, but if we've got a list of items like we do on page 3, Romanettes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 all have to be met. And that's our statutory construction. That's how we draft the laws. I'm afraid if you put these extra ands in there, we might be sending a message as a legislature or something else. So I appreciate the thought, but all five of those elements have to be met. So I would encourage you not to vote for the Standing Committee Amendment.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question? Question being called on the Standing Committee Amendment. All those in favor, please say aye. Opposed? The Standing Committee Amendment has failed.
Boy.
Chairman McKim, do you want to discuss the bill?
No, ma'am, I will turn the explanation of the Madam Chairman of the bill over to the good representative from District 55.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This is an old friend. We've seen this before. I'm not even for sure I supported it before, but I think we have it in better form this time. This is House Bill 108, Trespasser Responsibility. And what it does is codifies and preserves current Wyoming case law regarding trespassers. Under Wyoming case law, there are two exceptions to the general rule that a landowner owes no duty to a trespasser. First, the owner owes a duty not to willfully or wantonly injure a trespasser. And there was some testimony in committee about English common law and something called a spring gun, which apparently is just simply a shotgun propped up in the room with a string that goes to the door, and the trespasser opens the door and boom. That you can be sued for that if you're the landowner. On the second part, the owner may be liable for harm to a child trespasser under the attractive nuisance doctrine, which states that a landowner owes a duty of care to trespassing children for certain artificial conditions highly dangerous to children. House Bill 108 provides certainty as to what a landowner's duty of care is to a trespasser and does not leave a landowner's duty of care to the discretion of the courts. It just puts it in statute. This is supported and has been passed in a number of different states. It's supported by a number of ag and other organizations in Wyoming that cover all the major industries. And let me walk you through the bill briefly. On page 1, this bill creates Wyoming Statutes 3419201 and 3419204. 3419201 are just definitions of land, the owner, and trespasser. The new section 3419202, except as provided in 3519203, an owner of land owes no duty of care to a trespasser who is not liable for any injury to a trespasser, except that the owner owes a duty not to willfully or wantonly injure a trespasser. And then the part that got the most discussion in committee is coming up on page 3, 3419203. That's the artificial conditions highly dangerous to trespassing children. A, an owner of land is subject to liability for physical harm to a child trespassing on land caused by an artificial condition upon the land if, Romanet 1, the place where the condition exists is one upon which, and this is important, the owner knows or has reason to know that a child is likely to trespass. Romanet 2, and a condition is one in which the owner knows or has reason to know and which he realizes or should realize will involve an unreasonable risk of death or serious bodily injury to the child. And Romanet 3, and child, because of his youth, does not discover the condition or realize the risk involved, and intermingling it with or in coming within the area made dangerous by it. The utility of the owner maintaining the condition and the burden of eliminating the danger are slight as compared to the risk to the child involved, and the owner fails to reasonably exercise reasonable care to eliminate the danger or otherwise to protect the child. And 3419204 talks about conflicts. If this statute conflicts with an existing statute, the existing statute takes prominence. So that's the bill. We had some great testimony in committee on it. And without this bill, basically the courts are going to fall back to a restatement of torts from 2012. I believe this is the third one, which makes it worse for the landowners. We're trying to go back to what's already established in case law. That's the reinstatement of torts. I believe the second one from 1975. I don't actually know what those things are, but maybe the lawyers will explain that to us. So, again, this makes it more favorable to the landowners with this bill. Without this bill, it's going to be a little bit more serious landowner consequences. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Well, seeing no great rush to the microphone, are you ready for the question? Question being called, all those in favor of Representative McKim's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill 108 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 108 has passed the House. The next bill for our reading is House Bill 130. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 130 from Representative Burkhart, an act relating to public pensions, amending benefit computations from the paid fireman's pension account as specified, providing for a maximum benefit level for a member of the fireman's pension account, providing exceptions to the maximum benefit level for cost of living benefit increases and other increases as specified, providing a definition, providing applicability, and providing for an effective date. Madam Chairman, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom is referred House Bill 130, Fireman's Pension Account Benefit Adjustment, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Kennedy, Gay, Kasparic, Larson, Lockhart, Summers, and Walters. Two no votes, Representative Byrd and Edmund, signed by Representative Kasparic, Vice Chairman. Further reviewed by your Committee Number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 130, they respectfully report same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass. Those who voted aye, Representative Burkhart, Greer, Harshman, Moniz, and Stubson. Two no votes, Representative Connolly and Nicholas, signed by Representative Harshman, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 130 do pass. And I'll turn the explanation of the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment, not Standing Committee, the Committee of the Whole Amendment, to the good representative from the county with our largest prison.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And yes, that's correct. We do have the largest prison. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring to you House Bill 130, which is on Fire Pension Plan B. This is the plan that the paid firemen in the state are currently under. And A lot of our communities have both paid and volunteer firemen, and this is for the paid firemen, those who this is their profession. Easiest way to understand the bill, and if you've noticed, the amendment is fairly significant on it, is first to explain the current situation and then what the bill does and then handle the amendment. Currently, firefighters in that plan are limited to 25 years of service credit, meaning that they can work for 25 years and get credit for that service. If they work beyond 25 years, they get no credit for that continuing service. They can't go get 26 years worth of service. They can't get 27. They get 25, and that's where it ends. However, the inequality is they are required to continue to pay into the plan for any time they work beyond 25 years. So what happens is if a firefighter works for 26, 27 years, each of those years, they have to contribute 8.72% of their pay to continue to work. And the communities contribute the remaining up to 21%, which is their match. This bill eliminates that inequality. And what it says is the firemen who wish to work more than 25 years can continue to contribute to their retirement and get something for that. The idea was originally to force firemen to retire, and I've heard comments about, well, after 25 years, a firefighter should leave, they're ready to leave, they've had it with the service, and that's not something the state should be deciding. That's something that an individual should decide. If you've worked 25 years and you feel it's time to retire, that's fine, but you shouldn't be forced out by a statute that requires you to, in effect, pay for the privilege to continue to work. And that's the basis of the bill. Firefighters also, in that plan, cannot take their retirement until they're 50 years of age. So a firefighter who starts at 20, puts 25 years in, they can't even get their retirement for another 5 years. They would have to continue to pay into it with no gain and benefit. So the idea was to remove that and allow the firefighters to continue to build in their retirement and get rid of that inequality. For those of you who have worked in business, this is similar to a term that's often used in private industry called constructive termination, meaning we're doing you a favor by firing you or forcing you to leave. That hasn't stood up well in court. But it's a similar concept of forcing people out. So that was the original bill. After hearing testimony in both the Minerals Committee and Appropriations Committee, a number of us got together and found that with a lot of input and some more work, we could make the bill better. And that's what we've done. So at this point, Madam Chairman, I will move House Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 130 and discuss it.
Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, thank you. What the Committee of the Whole Amendment does is cleans up a lot of language, makes it very straightforward and a lot more understandable, and a big thanks to all the members of the Appropriations Committee who worked on this. Page 1, line 1, it creates accounts for contributions by members with more than 25 years of service, goes on to provide definitions, changes the line, but the real meat of the amendment starts on line 21 of your amendment. And what it says is that firefighters who work more than 25 years can contribute to their account, and those contributions are matched, and that those contributions are now held in a cash balance account, very similar to a 457 plan or a 401k plan. They're set aside for the members until what such time as they retire. When they retire, they can take those as either a lump sum or take them over a five-year period. And that's the basis of it. It keeps them intact. There is no additional money coming from the state. It's a pretty much neutral effect on the balance of the account. The original bill showed a very slight decrease over a long period of time, and the decision was we really didn't want the plan to decrease. So this was a compromise to that. And again, lets those firefighters who wish to continue to work to do so and not, in effect, have to pay a tax to continue to work. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. When it comes to retirement, my years are not advancing as fast as you might think, so I'm not really close to retirement myself. But as I look at this, my question is, why do we want to set up two accounts like that? Because I guess I don't see it as a tax on continuing to work. They're allowed to continue to work just because they've reached their maximum level at the retirement fund. To me, doesn't suggest that we need to create a separate fund for them, because generally the way these funds are set up, they're kind of dependent on everybody paying in, and it kind of takes into account that some people are going to work and quit before they're vested into the plan, and all those things are factored in. So somebody working later and continuing to the plan, it just supports the health of the plan. So I don't see how it's a tax. They still get their maximum benefits. I don't see why we need to change it. So I guess I'd like some comment on, you know, how is this different from somebody who works for a couple years and then quits and doesn't get a retirement?
Representative Burkhart.
Madam Chairman, thank you. The point is they worked for 25 years. They've contributed that period of time. If they continue to work, they're required, they don't have a choice, to pay into the retirement account. They continue to pay in, which is 8.725% of their pay. They get nothing for it. Their retirement is maxed out at 25 years of service. They get no more credit. They can't accumulate any more years. That is it. They're done. But if they wish to continue to work, and some of us would argue that's into your most productive years, they have to pay for that privilege. They don't have a choice. They can't say, no, I'm done, I'm maxed out, I'm not paying anymore. They have to continue to pay. The communities have to continue to pay for them. And there's no more benefit. They could work for another 10 years and get no more benefit out of their retirement than they earned at 25 years. And I frankly believe that's unfair.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I've got to ask a couple of questions that have been sent to me. How many firemen do you propose, do you guess, and I'll give you that this will be a guesstimate, will this apply to? And you said there'll be no money from the state. What do you guess could be the future liability of the cities and towns that employ these firemen?
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The number of people who may continue to work beyond 25 years is indeterminate. And the reason is most of them have left. Because they reach 25 years, know they're going to lose almost 9% of their pay a year for every year they work, so they've left. I would estimate that it's going to be a relatively small number. Normally, by the time someone's reached 25 years, they're a chief, a battalion chief. They're into those levels of fire service and that, and some of them wish to continue working. I guess, you know, maybe 2 to 3 dozen would continue to work. And the question about the towns, they're already contributing in, and the towns are getting no more benefit. All they're helping to do is subsidize the fund for whatever length of time the firefighter works.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I have a series of questions on both of these. The one question, of course, is a person can't miss is, instead of continuing to pay like you say they have to do now, why didn't you come up with a bill that said that after you've reached 25 years of service, you don't have to pay anymore? Now, the consequence of this is, the way you've got it, is that they can keep paying and paying and paying until they end up with a retirement check as big as their paycheck was, which is, you know, certainly goes beyond the bounds or the parameters that most retirement systems are structured around. So that's the question. The other one is that, you know, there's a lot more in this this standing or committee of the whole amendment than what you see here. And I'm going to line number 31, I guess, in the amendment. Upon retirement or termination, a member may withdraw funds from his account under this section in a lump sum. And, of course, that's another thing that, you know, if we open this up, to, you know, in a, I don't see that that was in the statute before, that they can draw it out in a lump sum. And I worry about the social goals of retirement if, you know, if someone could do that and go to a gambling mecca or something and spend their retirement funds and then come back and, you know, the other final thing I'm going to talk about that I don't like to see is that you go to the bottom page of the fiscal note. This raises the actuarially accrued liability about $3 million. And I don't like to see accrued liabilities going in that direction. I want to see liabilities going in another direction. So I've kind of covered a number of things here, but starting with the one on, you know, if somebody wants to work 26 years, he's hit 70% of his pay or 72, whatever it is, just say, okay, you can work, but you don't have to contribute anymore. And I would think that have a more favorable effect on the accrued liability of the actuarial condition. But I may be wrong.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To the question of why not stopping at 25 years, they are maxed out at also 70% of their pay at 25 years. So that's it. The other issue is a number of the firemen came and asked if there was something to do to cover them if they work beyond 25 years. This is not retroactive. It goes forward. There are a number of firefighters who currently have worked 27, 28 years, so it doesn't cover those years they've already paid into it. It's correct. The lump sum feature is not in the statutes. That was a recommendation by the retirement system as a possible way that they felt they could handle this in an easy manner. The money is theirs. Like I said, it fits into a cash account. They earn interest on it over time, not the same interest that the retirement system uses as their discount rate or the rate at which they project they'll return interest. It's about 2%. Actually, it's, I have to think here, 2.25% less, which is still a reasonable return. Currently, that's 5.5% that they feel can be earned on it. The actuarial numbers, right now, the plan is real close to 100% and probably will stay there. These changes allow the plan to increase above 100% over time, and over approximately 30 years would then it will decrease somewhat. And those numbers weren't available when this was put together. So there's a decrease in the actuarial funding in the plan, and it's an estimate depending on how many people you estimate right now are 23, 24, maybe even 25 years who plan to, you would guess, would stay in the plan and not leave. This allows that to be their choice. They can stay, they can go. So the actuarial numbers are going to fluctuate by the number of people that do stay. I would imagine someone who, say, started in the fire service when they were 30, 25 years, they're 55, they may choose to take their retirement and leave and not stay. Someone who started when they were 20, my indications they've given me is they would like to stay until they can collect their full retirement at age 50, so that's 5 years that they would leave. And I hope that answers the question.
Representative Pano.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just got a question, and I might have missed it here somewhere, but so there wouldn't be a ceiling, there wouldn't be a limit, say, to go to 30 years? Would this continue on 31, 32? Say if a person stayed 38 years, if you have a young individual that starts, say, at 20, 21, he decides to stay till, put in 40 years.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, they could continue on. The retirement is maxed out at 50, though, at 70% of their pay and that, and they could continue as long as they wish to continue to work, which for a lot of people is probably in their most productive years. And then the fire service, what you're getting for that is you're getting people who have a lot of accumulated knowledge, skills, and experience. And in this day and age, with a lot of the new materials in buildings, a lot of the new techniques, I think becomes vital to the communities.
Representative Pungo.
Madam Chair, thank you. My question, basically, that increases their percentage. Will it go to 80% that they would receive back from their pay? Is that, that's what I was wanting to know.
Representative Burkhart.
Madam Chairman, this change does not do that. They're still capped on their retirement at 70%. It's written oddly in the statutes. They get 2.8% of their pay up to 25 years, which works out to be 70%. And that's the way the statute is currently written.
Chairman Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try this mic. That one up there didn't work very well this morning. On the calculation of the payout, you're dealing here with the client, in my vocabulary, the client's ability to withdraw. And I'm sure you've probably thought of it, but does the wordage that you have there allowing 5 years of monthly payment and or a lump sum payment, is that all that you're providing? And then you leave the calculation to the board, as I read this. So if you wanted to, if the fireman wanted to take the money and went to work for the state of Wyoming, is it transferable in what sum, and is that possible? Or if they went into private business, a 401k of the employer, or an IRA in theirs, have you constricted what they can actually withdraw, or are you encouraging them to withdraw?
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The lump sum amount is money that is actually theirs. It's held in an account for them until such time as they retire. They can take it either in monthly payments over 5 years or take it as a lump sum. But it's already their money that they've contributed, just the same as all of a number of us have contributed into 401k plans or 457 plans or similar plans, or even put money away in the account for ourselves. They can roll it into a 401k. They can roll it into another plan. It is my understanding these firefighters cannot go to another fire department and start over again. That is actually prohibited in the statute. So they cannot leave at 25 years and go from, say, a town in the southwest corner to one in the center of the state and start over again. They are prohibited from doing that. They can't go to work in the fire service. So those are the constrictions on it. They can take it over 5 years, which was to help the retirement system not keep this money on the books for a long period of time, or they could take it in a lump sum. Just frankly, I retired and took money in a lump sum, and I guess if I wanted to go to the city with all the lights and gamble it away, I could have done that. I chose to do something more for my future with it.
Chairman Patton.
Just to follow up, well, what if they wanted to be mayor? Are they able to transfer the total amount or just the amount that they've put in? And in particular, are you just talking about the money on the five-year payout or the lump sum of just their contribution, not the employer's contribution, state's contribution?
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. There are two things here. There's the money that they get on their defined benefit plan. They are currently in a defined benefit plan that they will get, and they get a monthly payment for the rest of their life, like all the state's defined benefit plans. The other side is the money that will be held in a cash account for them. And so the state plan, if they retire and go to work for someone else, they can bank it or whatever on their monthly payment, and they could also do this with the lump sum. And those are the constrictions to the payout. If they get another job working for one of the large companies in the state and start building another retirement, they can take their monthly payment and have it deposited in a savings account or something else.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In a question on the amendment, because the amendment significantly changes the bill from what we heard in committee. The bill as it was presented in committee basically was intended to relieve the firefighter who chose to stay on past his 25th year from having to contribute his own funds into an account for which he had received no benefits for. In an effort to try and keep some of those firefighters on for an additional period of time, this amendment significantly changes that which we heard in committee, and I guess I'm just curious what stimulated such a significant change.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The main change was information from the retirement system indicating that the original language may have made the bill actuarially unsound over a period of time, and that was the reason for the change. The retirement system suggested something similar, well, what we've done, actually, and the people who asked that the bill be brought forward were good with that. So that's the main reason for the change, is to maintain a lot better actuarial soundness in the plan.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm to understand it right, the way it's presented in the House is that after 25, or in committee, is after 25 years that fireman would not pay any more of his contributions. However, the entity for which he was working would continue to contribute to that account. And so I'm struggling to find out why that would make the account less solvent. And under this amendment, he now contributes after that 25th anniversary, as well as his employer contributes, and then he's able to withdraw that. And I don't see where that makes it more financially sound.
Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The original bill removed the 25-year cap, which allowed their retirement to continue to build at the rate of 2.8% per year. So in 10 years, it would be 100% of their pay. And that would make the fund actuarially unsound, is paying someone out at 100% of their pay. And that was the main reason for the change and why it started to become actuarially unsound over a long period of time.
Is there any more discussion on the amendment? Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole amendment to House Bill 130, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That was rather lame. The amendment passed. Is there any further discussion specific to the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of, I forgot who brought it, Representative Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill 130 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The bill has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 142. The reading clerk will read the bill.
What's on it?
No.
Where's the? Okay. Where's the? I don't seem to have a list. Oh, okay. Okay.
Beg your pardon. House Bill 146. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill number 146 from Speaker Brown, an act relating to the Uniform Trust Code providing protection against liability for a trustee who consents to a modification or termination of a trust in good faith, providing that a distribution from a discretionary trust to a beneficiary does not create an interest in property, amending creditors' claims against settlor as specified, amending powers of the trustee as specified, and providing for an effective date. Madam Chairman, in Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 146, Uniform Trust Code, respectfully reports the same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass for amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Escobel, Halverson, Kroger, Crone, Miller, Pelkey, Pinnell, and Winters, signed by Representative Kroger, Vice Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Vice Chairman Kroger?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 146 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. I will dispose of the amendment very quickly. All it does is fix a grammatical mistake, changing a plural to a singular. If there are no questions on the amendment, I would call for the question.
Question having been called, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted, and we are back on the bill.
Thank you, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good speaker.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Sensing that you are all would rather have the short version of this explanation than the long version, I will go with the short. If you object to that, why, I'll go with the long. We're back deep in the Uniform Trust Code, with a number of technical changes. The first one, on page 2, running from lines 4 through 8, makes it clear that a beneficiary has no property interest in a discretionary trust. And that only makes sense. It just clarifies the case. If it's a discretionary trust, then the trustee makes distributions at his discretion, and it just makes it clear, as it should, that the beneficiary has no property interest in it. That has important implications in bankruptcy law and creditor protection. The next change, which is on page 2, lines 17 through 21, and it carries over on page 3 for lines 1 through 7, removes the requirement that a trustee be limited to a regulated financial institution. And that has proven to be unworkable with many trustees and with many trust attorneys, and it needs to be broadened. The trustee cannot be subordinate to the settlor, and that's a whole estate tax deal I could spend a half an hour on, and I don't think you want to hear it. But there's cautionary language in there that says the trustee can't be subordinate to the settlor. If he is, the effect is it makes the corpus of the trust included or he can't be subordinate, to the settlor. If he does, it makes the trust corpus part of the settlor's estate. And that's not what you're trying to do with one of these trusts. So really what it does is just open it up and say it can be somebody besides a financial institution as a trustee, but they cannot be subordinate to the settlor. Then starting on page 3 at line 14, we're adding 4 powers for trustees, 4 additional powers in addition to the enumerated powers that are in the Act. The first one, which is Romanette 29, XXIX, that'd be lines 14 through 18 on page 3, says that the trustee can make distributions and pay trust expenses from a trust with subtrusts or sharers. And the reason for that is sometimes these things need to be divided into subtrusts, and if without this power, a trustee may not be able to manage those properly, and it can cause tax problems, or it can cause one subtrust to get out of whack with another. That's a technical term. The second change, which is Romanette 30, which starts at line 20 on page 3 and runs through line 2 on page 4, allows a trustee to separate a trust with more than one beneficiary into subtrusts or into separate trusts so that he can manage those and perhaps apply different investment strategies. Maybe you have a trust for 2 kids. One is married with kids and has some kind of a regular job, and the other one's going to medical school. So the trustee gets in a bind trying to manage the whole trust for the 2 of them because they've got different needs and different expectations and different demands on the fund. So this would allow the trustee to divide it into separate subtrusts so that he can manage it manage it for each of those beneficiaries. The third change, which is Romanet 31, starts on line 7 on page 4 and runs through line 11, allows a trustee to decide on an annual basis whether capital gain income should be taxed in the trust or treated as distributed to the beneficiaries as a part of the discretionary principal distributions. And this time I do have all the numbers, but I don't think anybody wants to hear it, but there's a lot of tax implications because if a trust has over $12,150, it hits a tax bracket that the beneficiary doesn't hit. And if the money's conduit, if you use the trust as a conduit and run that money out in the year that it's received, then it's not income to the trust. So if you have to retain it in the trust, it's going to hit a tax bracket that may be avoided by distributing it out to the beneficiaries in the same year. And this makes it clear that a trustee can do that with capital gain income. The fourth change, which is Romanet 28, no, 32. This is wrong in here. 32. No, that isn't right. Okay, the last change is this paragraph B that starts at line 13 on page 4 and runs through the end. The purpose of this is to, this is about decanting, another area that we could spend half a day on. Decanting is the ability of a trustee to take a trust and cascade it down into another trust. And this actually restricts the power of decanting. The Uniform Trust Code has powers of decanting that we're worried about. And a trustee might be able to do decanting in a way to disqualify the trust from receiving income tax or estate gift or generation skipping tax transfer benefits that were intended for the original trust. And the amendment does not allow the power that's granted under this part of the Uniform Trust Code to decant a trust to a new trust in a manner that would prevent qualification for tax benefits intended by the original trust. So it's just a trust. Decanting means you can take a trust and move it into another trust. There was the potential that by decanting a trustee could change the tax benefits to the detriment of the trust. And so this is putting a restriction on it and saying, yeah, you can decant it. There are good reasons to decant it, but you can't do it to the tax detriment of the trust as it was originally structured. So, Madam Chairman, that's an explanation of the amendment or of the bill, and I'd stand for any questions.
Is there anyone who wants to hear the speaker's long version? Question being called. All those in favor of Vice Chairman Croker's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill 146 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 146 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 137. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Well, are we not doing 137?
Oh, here we go.
Oh.
House Bill 137 from Representative Northrup, an act relating to child custody and visitation, providing for an order of joint custody as specified, amending the definition of income for determination of child support as specified, amending the calculation for presumptive child support as specified, providing an accounting of child support proceeds, amending imputed income of voluntary, unemployed, or underemployed parent as specified, providing definitions and providing for an effective date. Madam Chairman, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 137, Child Custody, respectfully reports saying back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with following amendments. Those who voted aye, Representatives Baker, Esquivel, Halverson, Croker, Crone, Miller, Pinnell, Winters, one no vote, Representative Pelkey, signed by Representative Miller, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 137 do pass.
And do you wish to move, Representative Northrup? Go ahead, Representative Northrup.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Also on 137, there's an amendment, so I would like to move the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 137, and I'll explain it as I work the bill. All right. This bill is on child custody, and what we're trying to do here is to direct the judge to consider joint custody unless there's evidence that it's not in the best interest of the kids or the children. So working the amendment through this, on line 5, after specified on page 1, providing for an accounting of child support proceeds, we're going to strike that out of it because nobody wants to go through a shoebox full of receipts and look to see what's in there, how the money was spent. We'll move into page 2. Page 2 is the disposition of the maintenance of the children in decree or order. And on this page, the new language says the court shall enter an order of joint or shared custody unless there's a preponderance of evidence that I, a sole or primary, and that's part of the amendment, it's on page 2, line 12, or primary custody arrangement is in the best interest of children, or the parties no longer reside within 50 miles of each other and sole custody is the only practical arrangement. For the purposes of this next section, H, joint custody means, and that's another part of the amendment, on page 2, line 21, we're going to delete the physical residence. We're deleting line 22, deleting line 23, and on page 3, line 1, delete up to and, so that now it reads, joint custody means both parents share the decision-making rights, responsibilities, and authority relating to the health, education, and welfare of the children. And then we define shared custody, which means that the children physically reside with each parent for a substantially equal amount of time. And then we go on to define sole custody or primary custody, which means that awarding custody to one parent and establishes that the parent as a primary care provider of the children and the one with whom the children shall reside. So as we're going through this, we started looking at the income, and on page 4, there is in case law that tax refunds have been used as part of the income. So we added that into the whole thing about income. On the bottom of page 4, because when I was working with the people in the big white building across the way who work with families, I messed up the way in which they wanted it specifically stated, and so we're striking out some of the language on page 5 and moving it over to the front of item C on the bottom of page 4. And so what you will find is that item C now reads, the total number of days that each parent shall have the children in their care shall be calculated. And then we're striking all of line 21, all of line 22, all of line 23. We're reinserting them. I'm sorry, I messed that up. And we reinsert the stricken language. And then on page 5, we reinsert the stricken language on page 1 and page 2. And then you'll see that after the word obligation, that the total number of days is actually there. And we're striking out that portion, which is on line 2, line 3, and line 4, and down to obligation on line 5. Doing this, trying to define what joint custody is, what sole custody is, and what shared custody is in the eyes of the court. On page 6, a little bit more about the income. On line 12, the new language says, at the prevailing wage and salary levels in the local area in which the parents reside. In other words, there's a difference between someone who lives up near those big, beautiful mountains on the western side of the state and someone who lives out on the prairie in the middle of Wyoming as far as their wage that they can receive. With that, I move the amendment and ask for questions.
Hearing no discussion on the amendment, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye. Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted, and we are back on the bill. Is there any discussion on the bill?
ask for question on the bill?
Question being called. All those in favor of Vice Chairman Croker's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill 137 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Well. pursuant to House Rule 66B, the bill having failed a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. Having failed a standing division vote. Oh, beg your pardon. Sorry. So, House Bill 137 has passed Committee of the Whole. The Madam Majority Floor Leader.
I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Madam Chairman, a Committee of the Whole having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave report as follows. House Bill 103, amended and further amended and further amended, recommended do pass. Representative Berger moved that the House rise and sit again. House Bill 128, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill or House Joint Resolution 3, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 108, recommended do pass. House Bill 130, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 146, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 137, amended, recommended do pass. Sign off by Representative Wilson, Chairman.
I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Yay, Representative Wilson. We are at that order of business of introduction, reading, and reference of bills. The first bill for our consideration. House Bill 243.
House Bill 243 from Representative Brown, an act relating to crimes and offenses.
House Bill 243, introduced by Judiciary, assigned to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. The next bill for our consideration, House Bill 234.
House Bill 234 from Representative Edmonds, an act relating to the...
House Bill 234, assigned to Appropriations Committee Number 2. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 244.
House Bill 244, from Representative Throne, an act relating to severance taxes.
House Bill 244, assigned to Revenue Committee Number 3. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 242.
House Bill 242, from Representative Winters, an act relating to continuing contract teachers.
House Bill 242, assigned to Education Committee Number 4. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 235.
House Bill 235, from Speaker of the House and also Representative Brown, wherever he may be. And it's an act relating to foreign corporations and foreign limited liability partnerships.
Speaker Brown / Representative Brown's bill, House Bill 235, has been assigned to Corporations Committee Number 7. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 241.
House Bill 241, from Representative Dave Swanitzer, an act relating to motor vehicle driver's license.
House Bill 241 has been assigned to Transportation Committee Number 8. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 237.
House Bill 237, from Representative Moniz, an act relating to water and sewer districts.
House Bill 237 has been assigned to Minerals Committee Number 9. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 236.
House Bill 236, from Representative Throne, an act relating to the Wyoming Occupational Health and Safety Act.
House Bill 236 has been assigned to Minerals Committee Number 9. House Bill 239.
House Bill 239, from Representative Throne, an act relating to employment.
House Bill 239 has been assigned to Minerals Committee Number 9. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 238.
House Bill 238, from Representative Crone, an act relating to taxation and revenue.
House Bill 238 has been assigned to Minerals Committee Number 9. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 240.
House Bill 240, from Representative Harshman, an act relating to education.
House Bill 240 has been assigned to Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee Number 10. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 245.
House Bill 245, from Representative Wilson, an act relating to Medicaid.
House Bill 245 has also been assigned to Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee Number 10. And the last bill for our consideration is House Bill 246.
House Bill 246, from Representative Crone, an act relating to professions and occupations.
And House Bill 246 has been assigned to Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee Number 10. That is it for introduction and reading and reference of bills. The next thing for our consideration is reports from standing committees.
Madam Chairman, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom we referred House Bill 201, deposits by political subdivisions, respectfully reports same back to the House with a recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Those who voted aye, Representative Blackburn, Edwards, Jennings, Paxton, and Dan Zwanitzer. Those who voted no, Representative Gay, Kirkbride, Lindholm, one excused, Representative Byrd, signed by Representative Dan Zwanitzer, Chairman. Let's see.
Committee announcements. Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, February 3rd, upon noon recess in H-18 to hear the following two bills: House Bill 228, Subdivision Family Exceptions, and House Bill 188, Board of Occupational Therapy Amendments.
Chairman Miller.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room H8 to consider the following bills, House Bill 187, House Bill 211, and House Bill 214. We will continue at the noon recess tomorrow to consider Senate File 14 and House Bill 146.
Chairman McKim.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. Your Committee Number 5, Agriculture, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in H-11 to consider House Bill 47, Shipment of Wine. And I was told that there will be no whining at this time.
Ooh.
Thank you. Also, we'll consider House Joint Resolution Number 10, Magna Carta.
Vice Chairman Northrup.
Thank you, Majority Floor Leader. Your Committee Number 4, Education, will meet upon adjournment in Room H-10 to consider the following bills, House Bill 190, Hathaway Scholarship, Grade Point Average, House Bill 191, Education Hathaway Scholarship Requirements, House Bill 192, Hathaway Scholarship Program, House Bill 179, Education State Board Membership, and House Bill 144, Education School Safety and Security, if we have enough time. Thank you.
Chairman Petroff.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. Your Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, will be meeting tomorrow morning, February 3rd at 8 a.m. in Room 302 to hear House Bill 156, Abortion, Ultrasound Information. And, Madam Majority Floor Leader, if I could please have two privileges of the floor. We have several spots left on our tour of the Quebec One missile site on Wednesday morning at 7 a.m., so please let me know if you're interested and if you'd like to bring a guest or a spouse or a friend there, anyone else. And the second announcement is that I have order forms on my desk and we'll have them for the rest of the week, so through this week, to order the 3-set coins for the special edition alloy limited edition sets or the silver or gold coins. Again, I'll have those at my desk for the next week. Thank you.
Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Your Committee Number 8, Transportation License Plates and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow night, 10 minutes after adjournment at H-17, to discuss the following bills. House Bill 219, Decorated Combat Veterans License Plates. House Bill 220, Wyoming Coal Specialty License Plate. House Bill 197, Emergency Tow Vehicles and Wreckers. And House Bill 206, Bicycles on the Roadways.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Majority Floor Leader, your Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet in 10 minutes after adjournment, in 10 minutes from now, in Room H-17 to consider the following bills, House Bill 163, Critical Access Hospital Endowment Challenge Program, House Bill 174, Nicotine Products Regulation, House Bill 183, Insurance Coverage, Early Refills of Prescription Eye Drops.
Madam Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. Privilege of the floor.
Yes.
Some of you have been asking me about mugs. I've had the mugs in the minority office for quite some time now. I just have not had time to distribute them. But I will plan to be in the minority office, which is up here at the end of the hall, tomorrow morning by about 9:30, if people would like to come retrieve mugs and also give me money if you haven't already. Thank you.
Chairman Harshman.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader. House Committee Number 2 will meet upon adjournment with the Senate Committee for Joint Appropriations for the final review of the supplemental budget, House Bill 1. And also, Madam Chair, your Committee Number 2 will meet tomorrow morning, Tuesday, February 3rd at 8 a.m. to consider re-referred bills, House Bill 107, House Bill 118, House Bill 138, House Bill 152, and House Bill 209. In addition, Madam Chairman, at noon recess, we will consider House Joint Resolution 11, House Bill 225, and House Bill 189. And upon recess, Madam Chair, we'll consider House Bill 91, House Bill 133, and House Bill 131. And, Madam Chair, House Bill 162 that we began work on today at noon recess will be laid back pending further notice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We also have the chairman's meeting, which will be on adjournment in room 302 on Tuesday, February 3rd. And also we'll have Rules Committee, Committee Number 12, that will meet upon adjournment on Thursday, February 5th. And with that, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, that clears the deck.
Thank you, Madam Majority Floor Leader, and good work today, ladies and gentlemen. It's like my father always said, if you have to shoot, aim high so you don't hit the groundhog. But the Majority Floor Leader has left a lengthy list of bills for general file tomorrow. In order, they are House Bill 126, 159, 122, 180, 77, 112, House Joint Resolution 7, House Bill 172, 198, 147, 215, 182, 177, 121, 181, 135, 154, 155, 157, 136, 149, 143, House Joint Resolution 9, House Bill 28, and House Bill 142. So we have a little work to do tomorrow. And with that, Madam Majority Floor Leader, I would move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Tomorrow, February 3rd.
All those in favor, please say aye. Motion carried. Adjourned.